From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! An 11th-hour delay in the confirmation of what would be the first openly gay Episcopal bishop in the United States. We'll go to the meeting in Minneapolis where the controversy is underway. 58 years after the dropping of two atomic bombs on Japan, 150 top U.S. officials and military contractors meet in Nebraska to develop plans for the U.S. to expand its nuclear arsenal. We'll take a look at a Peruvian oil pipeline that's being pushed by the Bush administration. Among other companies, it will benefit Halliburton. And there are two new websites. We'll look at what they say. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The cover-up in Washington of possible Saudi ties to al-Qaeda and 911 continues. The Treasury Department is now refusing to release the names of Saudi individuals and organizations that the U.S. has investigated for possible links to al-Qaeda and other similar groups. Just a week ago, the Treasury Department promised to give senators the information, but yesterday the department reversed itself, announced the data had become classified. Yesterday, Pennsylvania Senator Republican Arlen Specter threatened to subpoena the Treasury Department for the information. The White House recently classified a 28-page section of the Congressional 911 report that dealt with Saudi ties to the 911 attacks. It's also been revealed that a top Treasury official last week told Senate staff members that the State Department had intervened on a number of occasions to keep the Treasury Department from adding certain Saudi entities to its watch list of terror suspects. At least 10 people are dead and 70 more injured in the Indonesian capital of Jakarta after a car bomb exploded at the American-run Marriott Hotel. Police said it was likely the work of a suicide bomber. The bombing occurred 2 days before a court was expected to issue a verdict in the trial of the key suspect in last fall's bombing in Bali that killed over 200 people. And in another trial, a senior Indonesian general, Adam Demiri, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for, quote, committing gross human rights violations in East Timor. In 1999, Indonesian soldiers under Demiri's command massacred at least 1,000 Timorese. The killing occurred in the lead-up to the vote for East Timor's independence from Indonesia. Secretary of State General Colin Powell yesterday dismissed as, quote, gossip, reports that he and his deputy, Richard Armitage, plan to resign at the end of this term, even if President Bush is elected. Powell, however, did not outright deny the reports that first appeared in The Washington Post. The leader of the Philippines' main Muslim rebel group, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, has died. The announcement was made yesterday, even though Salamat Hashim died 2 weeks ago. Peace talks between the group and the government are expected to continue. This news from the campaign trail. Presidential candidate Joseph Lieberman yesterday warned against the Democratic Party from supporting extremist candidates like former governor Howard Dean. Citing Dean's opposition to the war and his opposition to Bush's tax cuts, Lieberman said Dean represents a, quote, ticket to nowhere. Largely unknown nationally a year ago, Dean has emerged as a surprise front runner in the race. Dean's photo graces the cover of both Time and Newsweek this week. Lieberman's comments mirror the message of the Democratic Leadership Council. The chair of the council, Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana, said last week, "The administration is being run by the far right. The Democratic Party is in danger of being taken over by the far left." California Governor Gray Davis yesterday asked California's Supreme Court to delay the gubernatorial recall until March to coincide with the primary election. Meanwhile, with Davis's approval rating below 25%, California's Democratic Party leadership is now considering putting forward a candidate within the party in case voters oust Davis. Saturday is the deadline for candidates to enter the race. Hundreds have. The city of New York is launching a new program to review hundreds of unsolved sex crimes using DNA profiles in a program called John Doe Indictment Program. The city plans to file charges against sex abusers based on the DNA evidence even before they've linked the DNA to a suspect or before they've arrested a suspect in the crime. This will allow the city to potentially try hundreds of cases before the 10-year statute of limitation runs out. New York will begin by reviewing 600 cases from 9 years ago. Critics of the plan, including criminal defense attorneys, say the program would essentially skirt statute of limitations regulations. And the Bush administration yesterday said it may reduce a $9 billion aid package to Israel if the Israeli government continues construction of a wall cutting off Gaza and the West Bank.
From the blood-stained soil beneath my feet. The thorns outnumber the petals on the rose, and the darkness amplifies the sound of printer's ink on propaganda page that will rule your life and fuel my rage. Ooh,
Terrence Trent D'Arby, as yet untitled, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, as I said in the headlines, the Bush administration has said it may reduce a $9 billion aid package to Israel if the Israeli government continues construction of a wall cutting off Gaza and the West Bank. Congress approved the loan guarantees this spring, including $1 billion in military aid. According to the New York Times, administration officials say the possible change in policy comes in response to a campaign by Palestinian leaders who argue the wall will cut off Palestinians from their homes, farms, jobs, and school. Aides to Israeli President Ariel Sharon, Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, say the discussion with the Bush administration about the barrier remains friendly. Secretary of State Colin Powell said today on the U.S. government-owned Radio Sawa in the Middle East that the administration is in discussions with our Israeli friends, he said, to make sure the barrier did not become a hindrance to the peace efforts. He made no mention of reducing assistance. This morning, Israeli troops arrested 47 Israeli and international activists occupying a house in Masha near the town of Qalqilya, where the so-called security wall will run through a Palestinian family's property. The Israeli military says it may deport 41 international solidarity activists who were a part of the protest. Shortly before the program, we talked to Saif Abu Keshek, coordinator of the International Solidarity Movement. He's a Palestinian who lives in a refugee camp near Nablus. He spoke to us from an Israeli police station where he's being detained along with the scores of other protesters arrested this morning. He describes what happened.
That's how the Palestinian village came here to Nablus. Since they started in the wall, it's after the separation wall, they took a huge part of the land there. And originally for settlements being built at the land of Masha. This is a small village. And we've been trying to have an action supporting a Palestinian family. They are going to build the wall in front of their house. And their house is away 10 meters from a settlement called Al-Kana. So by this, they will be included by the settlement, between the settlement and the wall of the settlement and the outside wall. And what we've been trying is to send a media message that what's going on here is legal separation. It's not security. It's stealing the Palestinian land. It's at the opposite completely with what Sharon said, that he will try to not harm the Palestinians. It's the most harmful thing can happen, because they can go with the wall of the settlement, but they didn't do it. And we've been all of us together trying to stop this thing. Around 6:30 in the morning, they came and they said, in half an hour, if you don't leave, you will be arrested all, evacuated from this place. And then, surely our decision was that we are not leaving. So, half an hour later, they came with people wearing civil clothes, with soldiers, with police, with border police, and they were physically removing us from the site of the action, and it's been really harmful for several people, and several people being beaten too. Then they put us in the bus, and also physically they were pushing us. This is what happened till, like, we've been in the bus, and we've been, all of us, inside the bus around 7:30. 39 international, 3 Palestinians, and 3 Israelis. So all of us, 45 persons who've been arrested. All of us now in a real police station. And the next step, that the main group, or the, like, the internationals, is demanding that the wall is the biggest issue, and what we did is an example, and we will have jail solidarity till they release everybody, Palestinians, Israelis, and internationals. So all will, like all the internationals, will try to resist being released if any Palestinian or international or Israeli is still in the prison.
Saif Abu Keshek, coordinator of the International Solidarity Movement, a Palestinian who lives in the refugee camp near Nablus. He was speaking to us from an Israeli police station where he, along with scores of Palestinian and international activists, were taken after being arrested protesting what the Israeli military calls the security wall, what many others call the apartheid wall. You are listening to Democracy Now! The Episcopal Church yesterday delayed a final vote confirming the election of the denomination's first openly gay bishop. The vote was delayed after allegations emerged in the 11th hour that Reverend Gene Robinson inappropriately touched a man and is affiliated with a website that has a link to what people described as pornography. Robinson was subjected to extensive background checks by the church before being elected bishop by New Hampshire Episcopalians on June 7th. The allegations yesterday were made public less than an hour before the House House of Bishops was scheduled to begin debate, and after the House of Deputies already voted to confirm him. Of the two allegations Robinson faces, the more serious is one that came in an email from David Lewis of Manchester, Vermont, saying that he had inappropriately touched him. Lewis sent the email to some Episcopal bishops Sunday night, identifying himself as a heterosexual, saying, quote, "As outstanding as Gene Robinson may have been thus far as a priest and diocesan administrator, my personal experience of him is that he does not maintain appropriate boundaries with men. I believe this is an alarming weakness of character that alone makes Gene unsuitable for the office of bishop." Lewis continued in this email by saying, quote, "He put his hands on me inappropriately every time I engaged him in conversation. No gay man has ever behaved towards me this way, and I've had over 25 years of associations with gay male colleagues in Boston, New York, Los Angeles, and San Diego show business communities," unquote. The second allegation is that Robinson has an affiliation with an organization called Outright, a secular peer support group for gay teenagers, and that the Outright website includes links that can lead users to websites that some consider pornographic. The concern about the website was first raised by conservative web journalist David W. Virtue. In his digest yesterday, Virtue wrote that the organization's website, quote, "rather than leading young people to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ, offers adolescents a church-affirmed invitation to illegal, immoral, and perverse sex." The vote on the appointment of Robinson has threatened to divide the worldwide Episcopalian Church, an association of 70 million people in churches in 164 countries. We turn now to Reverend Michael Hopkins. He is president of the Episcopal Gay Advocacy Group Integrity. Founded in 1974, it is the leading grassroots voice for the full inclusion of gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered persons in the Episcopal Church. Reverend Hopkins is also the rector at St. George's Episcopal Church in Glendale, Maryland, speaking to us from Minneapolis, where he's attending the church's general convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Reverend Hopkins.
Good morning. Pleased to be with you.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you go through what has happened over this last 24 hours?
Well, yesterday was quite a day for all of us. The revelations were certainly stunning on a day when many of us expected to be able to celebrate. However, by the end of the day, I and many others felt hopeful that particularly the allegations about Kenan Robinson from the man in Vermont could be fairly quickly cleared up and we could move on with this process.
Can you talk about how these allegations first surfaced? Has there been any discussion with the person named in the email who sent the email, a David Lewis of Vermont?
I only assume that the process includes significant conversation with him. I myself don't know the person and in fact, haven't been able to find anyone here at the convention who does know him.
And what about the other allegation about the website of Outright?
I believe that allegation was the conservative element in the church making a stretch for a last-minute excuse to sway moderate bishops. That website link was the kind of thing that could happen to almost any of us. You know, those of us who are live in this internet world are three clicks away from almost always three clicks away from something that we'd rather not be associated with.
What are the supporters of Gene Robinson doing now? How are you organizing? Right now, the vote, as of yesterday, by the second house has been put off. The convention goes till Friday. What are you doing now?
we're simply saying our prayers and trusting the process. Thank God we're in a day when an allegation like this is made and the church automatically takes it seriously without any question whatsoever. The investigation, the process is honest and fair and thorough, but also pastoral to both sides. And we trust that process. We continue in our confidence, our trust in Gene, and believe that the process will do its work and that he'll be exonerated and we'll be able to go on.
What has been Gene Robinson's response?
Excuse me?
What has been Reverend Robinson's response?
He hasn't made any response, as anyone would expect. I mean, when one gets in a situation like this, one isn't really able to speak about it. I had very brief conversation with him yesterday, and my only question for him was if he felt he was being treated fairly, and he said he absolutely was, and that he himself trusted the process.
Looking at the Washington Post, it says the allegation involving pornography was brought to the attention of church lawyers Sunday night by the American Anglican Council, a Washington-based group devoted to orthodoxy that's vigorously opposed Robinson's election. Its president, the Reverend David Anderson, said its members found an internet link from the website of Outright, a secular outreach group for gay and bisexual youth, to a pornographic website. He said Robinson was a co-founder of the Concord, New Hampshire chapter of Outright and has publicly praised his efforts. But Anderson conceded that there is no evidence that Robinson had anything to do with the website or was aware of the alleged link to pornography. Anderson said he may be completely innocent and he deserves a chance to defend himself. What about the significance of what Gene Robinson has represented and what it means for the church, this whole discussion of whether the church will be divided in two if for the first time an openly gay Episcopal bishop is confirmed?
Well, certainly those are the concerns and those are the threats from some quarters of the church. My own belief and my own read of the situation is that this church is a great deal more strong than is being said about it. There's a lot more that holds us together than drives us apart. And too many people within the church, within the national leadership, know and trust Gene Robinson and his personal integrity. I have to believe that we are going to be in a kind of family feud for a time, but like most families, there's more that's holding us together than can possibly drive us apart, and we'll be okay in the end.
Well, Reverend Michael Hopkins, I want to thank you for being with us, president of the Episcopal Gay Advocacy Group Integrity, speaking to us from Minneapolis, from the Episcopal Church's General Convention, which wraps up on Friday. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, there is a secret meeting that was secret until activists made it known to the general public, taking place 58 years after the dropping of the atomic bombs on Japan. It's about a new generation of nuclear weapons in this country. Stay with us.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Long time ago.
Where Have All the Flowers Gone, sung by Tommy Sands with Dolores Cain and Vedran Smilovic from the CD Where Have All the Flowers Gone, the songs of Pete Seeger, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. As we turn to what's happening this week in Omaha, Nebraska, this week is the 58th anniversary of the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On Thursday, 150 top U.S. officials and military contractors will quietly meet in Omaha to develop plans for the U.S. to expand its nuclear arsenal. The meeting was supposed to be top secret. The list of attendees hasn't been released. Rumor has it that Vice President Dick Cheney will be there. A man often compared to Dr. Strangelove, Kevin Payne, will also be there. There are expected to be no advocates for nuclear disarmament in the House. The agenda of the meeting is also unknown, but observers say those who will be in attendance are expected to begin rewriting the country's nuclear policy. Calls to resume nuclear testing are expected. So are calls to build a new generation of nuclear bombs. To get an idea of what will likely be discussed, you can just browse some of the headlines that have appeared in the nation's press over the past year. Facing a second nuclear age, Bush pushes for new nukes. A new nuclear age, planners design technology to withstand the apocalypse. Bush plans to serve little nukes at next war party. U.S. sees renewed role for nukes in military arsenal. The bomb is back. Well, to protest the government's return to nuclear-friendly policies, over the weekend, hundreds gathered outside the gates of the U.S. Strategic Command Center, better known as STRATCOM, where Thursday's meeting will be taking place. Four survivors of the U.S. nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were in attendance. Presidential candidate Denis Kucinich addressed the crowd. A handful of people there attempted to conduct citizens' weapons inspections at STRATCOM. Among those citizens' weapons inspectors was Greg Mello. He's executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. His organization revealed earlier this year that the government is planning to hold these secret nuclear discussions. He joins us on the phone right now from New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us, Greg. So tell us more about this meeting in Omaha, Nebraska at STRATCOM.
Well, it's almost unprecedented to bring this many senior decision makers in the executive branch and their contractors together to discuss nuclear policy. On the sort of terms of reference for this meeting are topics like how to frame the discussion in Congress, what kind of authority do we need to begin small production runs of special weapons, is the production complex agile enough to make these special weapons at short notice, what kind of nuclear testing do we need, and, of course, what are the weapons we want that will be, as they put it, most likely to be used? It is really a breathtaking agenda. Yesterday I learned that those congressional staff members, committee staff members, who want to just come and observe are being barred from the meeting. So we have a meeting which is pretty much stacked with contractors, and if it would be inaccurate not to say just ideologues, and congressional oversight is being stiffed at the door.
Mm-hmm. What do you say about the Pentagon saying it wants to develop a class of relatively small nuclear weapons? What does that mean?
It means many things. There are quite a few different candidates for production that will be discussed. We know this because the subject has come up in the 1990s. These plans aren't exactly new, but they have legs in the Bush administration they didn't have before. So there are going to be high-yield weapons discussed. They're going to be earth-penetrating weapons, so-called agent defeat weapons, which are optimized to attempt the crazy mission of trying to incinerate biological weapons or chemical weapons. They're going to be enhanced radiation weapons. Maybe you remember that, neutron bombs. There may even be some microwave weapon ideas brought to the table. We don't know all the kinds of weapons, but we know that they will run the gamut.
Can you talk about Keith Payne?
Keith Payne wrote an article in 1980. I think the title was Why Not Victory? There he suggested that the United States might be able to absorb losses of 20 million dead in a nuclear war with the Soviet Union, which, as you may remember, is not too different than what Buck Turgidson said in Dr. Strangelove. He has been very active in think tank circles that are close to the Bush administration, the NIP, the National Institute for Public Policy. I think he is or was the president. I haven't kept up whether he is in government in Mr. Rumsfeld's shop at this moment or he's gone back to NIP. In any case, our best information was he was going to be there. Now, whether that's true or not, it's actually not too important because his co-authors of that 1980 article are in the Bush administration as well. People that were on the margins at one time are now very central in policymaking.
So what are your plans for this week, and how did you discover that this meeting was taking place at Stratcom?
Well, a document kind of fell into our hands. We can't take a lot of credit for it wasn't one of these documents that you struggle for a year to get. It just kind of fell out of the sky. We would like to know who exactly is going to be there. We'd like to know what exactly is the agenda. We'd like to know what are the so-called pre-reads, the material circulated to the committee members, and what will be the outcome of this meeting, and how will it be applied in the decision-making process. All of this is hard to pry out, and I'm afraid that one of the things that makes it more difficult is that the Democratic opposition to these nuclear weapons policies is not firm enough. Most of the Democrats are a little passive about this, perhaps because they don't understand how dynamic this process is and how many of the cards in the deck already are in the hands of those who would proceed with nuclear testing, with development of these new weapons.
Greg Mello, I want to thank you for being with us, head of the Los Alamos Study Group, part of those protesting outside Stratcom this week in Omaha, Nebraska, where a major meeting that could launch a new generation of nuclear weapons is taking place. The United States Strategic Command, which is host of this meeting, controls the nation's deployed nuclear arms and writes the war plans for their use. We now turn to another nuclear story on this eve of the 58th anniversary of the dropping of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Last week, efforts to shut down the New York nuclear plant Indian Point was dealt a major setback. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, known as FEMA, endorsed the plant's emergency evacuation plan. Soon after, the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, approved the evacuation plan. This came despite claims by many state, local, and federal officials that the evacuation plan is flawed. New York Senator Hillary Clinton has said she's, quote, deeply disturbed by FEMA's decision. She called on FEMA to conduct a new test for the emergency plan for the Indian Point nuclear power plant within 6 months. Opponents of the nuclear plan had hoped rejection of the evacuation plan could help lead to the total shutdown of the plant, which is located about 35 miles north of Midtown Manhattan. Joining us to discuss and debate this issue, we are joined by Harvey Wasserman. Harvey Wasserman is senior advisor to the Nuclear Information and Resource Service and author of The Last Energy War. Mana Joe Green is on the line with us, Environmental Action Director of Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. She's one of the founding groups. That's one of the founding groups of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition. And Jim Steets joins us, who is a spokesperson for Entergy Nuclear Northeast, which runs the Indian Point Nuclear Power Plant. Why don't we start off with Jim Steets? Can you talk about the approval by both FEMA and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of the evacuation plan?
Well, sure, I'll be glad to. Thanks for having me on the program. The FEMA acts on behalf of the NRC since it has the expertise to determine the adequacy of the emergency response plan. And, of course, participates in the process that leads to the approvals. And so every year they go through a whole list of actions that they take to make improvements to the plan and to ensure that it's updated. And so in the January-February timeframe each year, the activities are documented and typically are forwarded to FEMA through the State Emergency Management Office, and then FEMA would then, looking that information or gaining information from its own participation in the process, can notify or write to the NRC or the state that the emergency response plans in the areas of the nuclear power plants are adequate to protect public safety. And just this last week, as we're all well aware, FEMA has done that. So this sort of annual ritual was just completed recently. And so the Indian Point plants, which for years have had an emergency response plan, and every year during that time, refines it or makes improvements, it's been acknowledged and ascertained by FEMA that the emergency response plan can adequately protect the public safety.
Mana Joe Green, then what is your concern with this evacuation plan?
Well, I think Jim accurately described it as a ritual. It is a ritual. It's a token rubber stamping. I don't think that that FEMA and then the NRC have done due diligence. The governor last year hired an independent, highly experienced team of people headed up by James Lee Witt, and the Witt report clearly indicated that it is impossible to evacuate the area around Indian Point safely. And in our opinion, in Clearwater's opinion, and the opinion of the Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition, and all of the people that are working on this issue, FEMA and the NRC have abrogated their responsibility to the public to protect public health and safety in this recent decision. Clearly, for the first time in history, all four counties involved refused to recertify this plan based on the concerns raised by the Witt report, and the state emergency management agency also refused to recertify. In our opinion, this plant poses a severe danger to the people in the New York metropolitan area, in Connecticut, and in New Jersey, and needs to be closed immediately and decommissioned carefully over time.
Harvey Wasserman, could you put this in a national context?
Well, these emergency evacuation plans were required by Congress after Three Mile Island, the accident in 1979 in Pennsylvania. And the idea of evacuating any nuclear plant in the face of a major meltdown is absurd, and probably most absurd anywhere in the country at Indian Point. I mean, the idea of that incredibly crowded area with the limited highway system is just the idea of getting people out of there in an emergency situation with a cloud of radiation being released at Indian Point is just it's nonsense. It's utter nonsense. It's completely irresponsible. It can't be done, and the nuclear plant needs to be shut down. We know that on September 11th, the first jet that flew into the World Trade Center, flew directly over Indian Point, had, God forbid, they decided to drop down a minute early and hit Indian Point, 99% of the people listening to this show would be dead or dying. And the entire New York area would be uninhabitable as per Chernobyl and or worse. And the idea that these plants should continue to operate is utter nonsense. We have plenty of alternative power to be gotten, and this has been going on for a long, long time. We've had a report at the Perry nuclear plant in Ohio that showed the same thing, that the place can't be evacuated. It's just completely irresponsible and completely money-driven by Entergy and the other owners of nuclear plants. Complete disregard of the public safety. These reactors are old. They're increasingly dangerous. They're being run irresponsibly, and the technology is really a technology that whose time never came. And to say these plants are obsolete is kind. They just don't have any justification for continuing to operate, and they need to be shut immediately. That's the long and short of it.
Jim Steets of Entergy, your response.
Well, the nonsense he's talking about is the nonsense he just told you. Nobody, except the people who have long opposed nuclear power, like the two that are on this program with me, are making the statements that you've heard just now. These plants are safe, they're secure, they're extremely important to the region, they're operated extremely well by Entergy, they are important facilities. Nobody is making the claims, except those who are opposed to Indian Point, that New York would be uninhabitable after an accident at the plant. These are not nuclear bombs. These are nuclear power plants that produce electricity. They're well-designed. Their containment buildings can withstand tremendous impacts. They have multiple cooling systems. They're responsibly run by a company that is recognized nationally as an expert in operating these plants.
What about this idea of a plane hitting the Indian Point nuclear plant?
Well, we were very confident soon after 9/11, after sitting down with our own civil and structural engineers and talking about designing these containment buildings, that they could withstand planes crashing into them. And the industry, in fact, spent $1 million studying this very subject, studying the potential impacts of a jet crashing into these containment domes. The fact is that these containment domes are different than any other structures in the world. They're not tall office buildings. They would not permit jet fuel to get inside them and burn and melt the steel that caused the collapse of the World Trade Center. And so we're very confident in the capabilities of these containment buildings. And, of course, the plane scenario isn't the only one that we consider. We've added security enhancements, unprecedented security enhancements, to an industry that already were the best defended and most secure non-military industrial facilities in the country.
Manager Joan Green, your response.
Well, even if that were all true, and there's a lot of question about the security of Indian Point and the whole security system, that would not apply to the fuel rods that are stored in a relatively unprotected building. So we think that it's an extremely vulnerable target, not just to a terrorist attack, but also it has a history of a safety record that is abominable. It is, and I want to give Entergy credit. I think there's been an effort to try to rectify some of the backlog of work orders and safety violations. However, until recently, it was listed as the worst in terms of the number of violations and also the actual internal incidents. The plant, Indian Point 2, was closed for 10 months during the year 2001, I believe. And during that time, it was closed due to a boiler, a deficiency in a boiler pipe that actually caused there was a breakage and a release of steam from that accident, and the whole plant was shut down for renovations. During that 10 months, Indian Point 2 was out of commission and not supplying electricity to the grid, and New Yorkers didn't know the difference. That's one of the two plants located at that site.
Let me ask Jim Steets, in the issue of the Witt Report, James Lee Witt, the former director of FEMA, who said that the evacuation plan is inadequate. Did that concern Entergy?
Well, it did.
FEMA's own director.
It did, because, you know, we poured through that document and found no explanation for the conclusion that it drew. It didn't explain what would occur at the plant that would make the plan inadequate. It came up with a or decided on a scenario without ever explaining the basis for it.
Harvey Wasserman, 20 seconds, last comment.
Well, you can see the basis of it every day at rush hour. We've already seen the Shoreham nuclear plant on Long Island shut down because of the absurdity of trying to evacuate in the face of an accident, and it's the same or worse at Indian Point. There's absolutely no way that you can evacuate that area in the face of an accident, which could occur for any number of reasons, due to all sorts of internal failures which have occurred at other reactors around the world, and basically you have a technology that needs to be gone. It has no place today.
None of which would prevent us from being able to evacuate the area in time.
We have to wrap up.
Around the plant disagree, you can't.
We have to wrap up the discussion. Harvey Wasserman of the Nuclear Information and Resource Service, senior advisor. His book is The Last Energy War, Manna Jo Green of the Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, and Jim Steets, spokesperson for Entergy, which runs the Indian Point nuclear reactor. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll talk about a Peruvian oil pipeline in Halliburton. Stay with us. Music of the Andes here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Two banks funded by U.S. taxpayer dollars will soon decide whether to go ahead with the Camisea gas project in Peru. Indigenous groups and environmental activists call the project destructive and financially unstable. The board of the Inter-American Development Bank is set to vote on Wednesday on whether to go ahead with a loan to finance the project. The U.S. Export-Import Bank, together with the IDB, could provide $300 million in loans to pave the way for financing the project. The main beneficiaries of the project are two Texas oil companies, Kellogg Brown & Root, a subsidiary of Cheney's Halliburton, and Hunt Oil Company, whose vice president was a top energy advisor to President Bush. Halliburton's set to get the billion-dollar contract for a coastline processing facility, and Hunt Oil is a primary partner in the consortium of oil companies building the pipeline. Two major investors in the Camisea project, Citigroup and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, have already pulled out, citing environmental and financial concerns. A consultant's report for the Export-Import Bank, obtained through Freedom of Information Act request, reveals the project violates the bank's standards and that the environmental assessments are, quote, woefully inadequate. The U.S. Agency for International Development issued a statement opposing the project, and more than a dozen senators, led by Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, wrote a letter to Treasury Secretary John Snow urging that the project be put on hold unless fundamental changes be made and environmental damage reversed. With the pipeline 60 to 70% complete, a report out from Amazon Watch says there's already significant damage to ecosystems and local indigenous populations. We're joined on the telephone right now by Atossi Sultani, who is the president of Amazon Watch, which is spearheading the international movement against the Camisea gas project, calling for it to be halted. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Tosa, can you talk about what evidence you have of the damage in Peru where this pipeline is being built and what its connections are to the Bush administration?
Well, first, in terms of damage, the companies broke ground over a year ago in the region and have been moving ahead, hoping that the loans will come as they continue to pave the way inside the forest. What we've seen is we've seen a complete devastation of rivers. We've seen massive landslides. We've had audits of the field, including engineers' reports showing extensive environmental damage. Erosion is choking pristine rivers and has been killing off fish stock. There's hours and hours. We have literally 13 hours of community testimonies talking about how there's no more fish and how the animals have left the region. We're talking about literally 7,000 riverine communities that live, 7,000 people who live along the river, Urubamba River, and the tributaries that are directly affected. And we believe that this project is putting their livelihood and their ability to live off the land at risk. In terms of the connections, you mentioned that Ray Hunt, which is the president of Hunt Oil, has a long-term friendship with the Bush administration. In fact, he, according to the Washington Post, raised over $100,000 for the Bush campaign, for the Republican Party. And in terms of his son, Hunter Hunt, has been also a Bush policy advisor on energy issues. In fact, this project is a chapter directly out of the Bush-Cheney energy plan, Chapter 8, which calls for increasing imports of natural gas, including from Latin America. And we're seeing this play out right now with U.S. tax dollars at stake.
A clip from your website of people talking in the area, in the Amazon, begins with Roger Rivas, who's president of the Machihuenga.
I believe that the forest is the life of the Machiginga people, as is all nature, the water, the fish, and all living things of the rainforest. That's the traditional way of life of the Machiginga. Therefore, without our ecosystems, we can't exist as the Machiginga. We can't live. Before, when we lived without the company and the pipeline that passes by here, we only used to get the flu. Now there is such a combination of illnesses that we can't identify the sicknesses that we are contracting.
Segakyato community member.
I went to see our brothers at Montetoni and saw a lot of illness. There's nothing but the flu. Also, everyone from the community, they're all sick. Just yesterday, a lady died. I am worried that all of them could die, as there are no medicines. All of them say they have pains in their bodies. It's happened here in Segakyato, too. This epidemic continues.
Just some of the voices from the Amazon. Where did you interview these people, Tosi?
There was a delegation that went along the Machiginga communities along the lower Urubamba River in middle of June. And the communities that are along the river are also are definitely suffering, but they're also isolated communities and populations of isolated and even uncontacted indigenous peoples inside the reserve that's going to be where the drilling happens. Now, the reserve was created because these people were contacted, some of them were contacted by Shell Oil in the 80s. Over half of them died, and now the government created a reserve to protect the remaining populations. These are people who've had little or no contact with the outside world, and now their land is being basically set aside for drilling. The company is flying helicopters over the reserve to basically scatter them and scare them away. And, you know, what we're seeing is where these people are at risk of life and death. The man you heard talking about, Montetoni, went to one of the recently contacted communities and reported serious illnesses and flus, and there are no medicines out there. So these people are at a risk of life and death. And, again, it's our tax dollars who are basically being given in this case, to these companies. We hope to fight it. The vote is supposed to be tomorrow, both at EXIM and the IDB, but we're working around the clock right now with a group of environmental groups from Friends of the Earth and Environmental Defense and others who are basically helping us fight it.
So you're talking about connections directly to the top of the Bush administration, from President Bush himself to Vice President Cheney. What role has he played?
Well, Halliburton's Hunt Oil, Ray Hunt of Hunt Oil, was appointed to the board of Halliburton by Vice President Cheney in the late 90s, and so there's a direct friendship there. And Peter Sabah, who is a chief operating officer and a general counsel of EXIM, is a Republican appointee who served as the undersecretary for the Department of Energy under Bush Sr., and who's a direct contributor to the Bush presidential campaign, and he's also within EXIM. So Philip Merrill is the president of EXIM, and he's a close friend of Vice President Cheney. So we're seeing a lot of direct ties with the Bush administration. In fact, this issue is now in the hands of the National Security Council and the State Department.
How did you get the information under the Freedom of Information Act about the report?
Actually, Friends of the Earth, my colleagues there, filed the information request, Freedom of Information request, and were able to release an internal document that was prepared by EXIM's consultants. And this internal report basically is very damning to the project. It shows how all of the impacts that we've warned about are already taking place, and that they're in many cases irreversible, irretrievable, significant long-term negative impacts. All of those statements are basically show that the project violates EXIM's environmental guidelines and policies.
So what is Amazon Watch calling for right now on this eve of the vote?
We're definitely calling for the vote not to happen this week, because virtually these agencies wouldn't bring up their issues to be voted on unless they had consensus. So if it comes up for a vote, it basically means it's going to pass. There's never been boards rejecting the vote. So basically, we're calling for the delay in the vote. We're calling for the project to be removed from the isolated and uncontacted people's reserve. There's also a marine reserve at risk in the coast of Peru where there's going to be the plants for the project. We're calling for the project to be removed permanently from both the indigenous reserve and the marine reserve.
Well, Atossa Saltani, I want to thank you very much for being with us, president of Amazon Watch, spearheading the international campaign to halt the Camisea gas project. And we did call Kellogg Brown and Root for comment. They said they could not join us on the program today. And that does it for the show. I want to welcome Martha's Vineyard TV, MVTV, to the viewers who are watching live right now. This weekend, I'll be on Martha's Vineyard, 8 o'clock on Saturday night, and Edgerton at the Old Whaling Church. And I'm looking forward to seeing folks there on Friday night in Nantucket, and on Sunday night with Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky in Provincetown. And look forward to seeing our viewers and listeners of WOMR as well, and other public access TV and radio stations in the area. Also, once again, tell your friends that Democracy Now! Is closed captioned on public access TV around the country and on Dish Network Free Speech TV, channel 9415, so people can finally get a chance to access Pacifica Radio, the 28 million Americans who are deaf or hard of hearing. We're very excited about this. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdel-Kaddous, Nell Geiser, Opa Patel. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.